You have expressed concern about this loose talk of war, as you call it, driving up gas prices further. Your critics will say on Capitol Hill that you want gas prices to go higher because you have said before that will wean the American people off fossil fuels onto renewable fuels. How do you respond to that?
Ed, just from a political perspective, do you think the President of the United States going into re-election wants gas prices to go up higher? Is there anybody here who thinks that makes a lot of sense? Here's the bottom line with respect to gas prices. I want gas prices lower because they hurt families. Because I meet folks every day who have to drive a long way to get to work, and them filling up this gas tank gets more and more painful and is a tax out of their pocketbooks, out of their paychecks. And a lot of folks are already operating on the margins right now. And it's not good for the overall economy, because when gas prices go up, consumer spending oftentimes pulls back. And we're in the midst right now of a recovery that is starting to build up steam, and we don't want to reverse it. What I have also said about gas prices is that there is no silver bullet, and the only way we're going to solve this problem over the medium and long term is with an all-of-the-above strategy that says we're going to increase production, which has happened. We are going to make sure that we are conserving energy. That's why we doubled fuel efficiency standards on cars, which will save consumers about $1.7 trillion and take about 12 billion barrels of oil offline, which will help to reduce prices. And we're going to develop clean energy technologies that allow us to continue to use less oil. And we've made progress. I mean, the good news is 2010, first time in a decade that our oil imports were actually below 50%, and they have kept on going down. And we're going to keep on looking at every strategy we can to, yes, reduce the amount of oil that we use while maintaining our living standards and maintaining our productivity and maintaining our economic growth. And we're going to do everything we can to make sure that consumers aren't hurt by it. Now, there are some short-term steps that we're looking at with respect to, for example, there are certain potential bottlenecks in refineries around the country that we've been concerned about. We're concerned about what's happening in terms of production around the world. It's not just what's happening in the Gulf. You've had, for example, in Sudan, some oil that's been taken offline that's helping to restrict supply. So we're going to look at a whole range of measures, including, by the way, making sure that my attorney general is paying attention to potential speculation in the oil markets. I've asked him to reconstitute a task force that's examining that. But we go through this every year. We've gone through this for 30 years. And if we are going to be competitive, successful, and make sure families are protected over the long term, then we've got to make sure that we've got a set of options that reduce our overall dependence on oil. Now, with respect to Israel, I'm not the first president who has been unable, because of a whole range of issues, not to visit Israel as president in their first term. I visited Israel twice as senator, once right before I became president. The measure of my commitment to Israel is not measured by a single visit. The measure of my commitment to Israel is seen in the actions that I've taken as President of the United States, and it is indisputable that I've had Israel's back over the last 3 years. I'm Amir Madani.
Thank you, Mr. President. Yeah. Do you believe Rush Limbaugh's apology to the Georgetown law student was sufficient and heartfelt? Do you agree with the decision of the growing number of sponsors that have decided to drop his show, stop supporting his show? And has there been a double standard on this issue? Liberal commentators have made similarly provocative or distasteful statements, and there hasn't been such an outrage.
You know, I'm not going to comment on what sponsors decide to do. I'm not going to comment on either the economics or the politics of it. I don't know what's in Rush Limbaugh's heart, so I'm not going to comment on the sincerity of his apology. What I can comment on is the fact that all decent folks can agree that the remarks that were made don't have any place in the public discourse. And, you know, the reason I called Ms. Flute is because I thought about Malia and Sasha, and one of the things I want them to do as they get older is to engage in issues they care about, even ones I may not agree with them on. I want them to be able to speak their mind in a civil and thoughtful way. And I don't want them attacked or called horrible names because they're being good citizens. And I wanted Sandra to know that that I thought her parents should be proud of her and that we want to send a message to all our young people that being part of a democracy involves argument and disagreements and debate, and we want you to be engaged, and there's a way to do it that doesn't involve you being demeaned and insulted, particularly when you're a private citizen. All right. Jessica Yellen. Jessica.
Apologize for what they said about that.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
Top Democrats have said that Republicans on a similar issue are engaged in a war on women. Some top Republicans say it's more like Democrats are engaged in a war for the women's vote. As you talk about loose talk of war in another arena, and women are, this could raise concerns among women, do you agree with the chair of your Democratic National Committee that there is a war on women?
Here's what I think. Women are going to make up their own mind in this election about who is advancing the issues that they care most deeply about. One of the things I've learned being married to Michelle is I don't need to tell her what it is that she thinks is important. And there are millions of strong women around the country who are going to make their own determination about a whole range of issues. It's not going to be narrowly focused just on contraception. It's not going to be driven by one statement by one radio announcer. It is going to be driven by their view of what's most likely to make sure they can help support their families, make their mortgage payments, who's got a plan to ensure that middle-class families are secure over the long term, what's most likely to result in their kids being able to get the education they need to compete. And I believe that Democrats have a better story to tell to women about how we're going to solidify the middle class and grow this economy, make sure everybody has a fair shot, everybody's doing their fair share, and we got a fair set of rules of the road that everybody has to follow. So I'm not somebody who believes that women are going to be single-issue voters. They never have been. But I do think that we've got a strong story to tell when it comes to women.
Language be changed?
Jessica, as you know, if I start being in the business of arbitrating, and what I do is I practice it. I'm going to try to lead by example in this situation as opposed to commenting on every single comment that's made by either politicians or pundits. I would be very busy. I would not have time to do my job. That's your job to comment on what's said by politicians and pundits. All right. Lori Montenegro.
Thank you.
There you are.
Mr. President, polls are showing that Latino voters seem to be favoring your reelection over a Republican alternative, yet some of them are still disappointed, others upset about a promise that you made on immigration reform that has yet to come to pass. If you are reelected, what would be your strategy? What would you do different to get immigration reform passed through the Congress, especially if both houses continue as they are right now, which is split?
Well, first of all, just substantively, every American should want immigration reform. We've got a system that's broken. We've got a system in which you have millions of families here in this country who are living in the shadows, worried about deportation. You've got American workers that are being undercut because those undocumented workers can be hired and the minimum wage laws may not be observed, overtime laws may not be observed. You've got incredibly talented people who want to start businesses in this country or to work in this country. And we should want those folks here in the United States. But right now, the legal immigration system is so tangled up that it becomes very difficult for them to put down roots here. So we can be a nation of laws and a nation of immigrants. And it is not just a Hispanic issue. This is an issue for everybody. This is an American issue that we need to fix. Now, when I came into office, I said, I am going to push to get this done. We didn't get it done. And the reason we haven't gotten it done is because what used to be a bipartisan agreement that we should fix this ended up becoming a partisan issue. I give a lot of credit to my predecessor, George Bush, and his political advisors who said, you know, this should not be just something the Democrats support. The Republican Party is invested in this as well. That was good advice then. It would be good advice now. And my hope is that after this election, the Latino community will have sent a strong message that they want a bipartisan effort to pass comprehensive immigration reform that involves making sure we've got tough border security. And this administration has done more for border security than just about anybody. That we are making sure that companies aren't able to take advantage of undocumented workers. That we've got, you know, strong laws in place. And that we've got a path so that all those folks whose kids often are U.S. citizens, who are, you know, working with us, living with us, and in our communities, and not breaking the law, and trying to do their best to raise their families, that they've got a chance to be a fuller part of our community. So what do I think will change? Well, what I will do, look, we're going to be putting forward, as we have done before, a framework, a proposal, legislation that can move it move the ball forward and actually get this thing done. But ultimately, I can't vote for Republicans. They're going to have to come to the conclusion that this is good for the country and that this is something that they themselves think is important. And depending on how Congress turns out, we'll see how many Republican votes we need to get it done. Nora O'Donnell, how are you?
Today is Super Tuesday, so I wonder if you might weigh in on some of your potential Republican opponents. Mitt Romney has criticized you on Iran and said hope is not a foreign policy. He also said that you are America's most feckless president since Carter.
Yeah.
What would you like to say to Mr. Romney?
Good luck tonight.
No, really.
Really? Lynn, since you've been hollering and you're from my hometown, make it a good one.
My question is about the switch of the G8 summit from Chicago to Camp David.
Mm-hmm.
A reason given from the White House is that now you wanted a more intimate summit.
Yeah.
People in Chicago would like to know, What do you know now that you did not know when you booked Hometown Chicago for the G8 that led to the switch? And what role did security threats possibly play in the decision?
Well, keep in mind, Lynn, we're still going to be showing up with a whole bunch of world leaders. We've got this NATO summit. Typically, what's happened is that we've tried to attach the G8 summit to the NATO summit so that the leaders in the G8 summit don't have to travel twice to whatever location. So last year in France, with NATO summit. We'll do so again. I have to say, this was an idea that was brought to me after the initial organizing of the NATO summit. Somebody pointed out that I hadn't had any of my counterparts who I've worked with now for 3 years up to Camp David. G8 tends to be a more informal setting in which we talk about